Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Tuesday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help HD Radio. This is Melissa Billiard, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1. We'll cue into the show. And please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio. Click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 86,000 listeners, for your support and interest in Help for HD programming. Tonight, we have an awesome, incredible Dr. Claudia Testa here. She is Associate Professor of Neurology and Associate Director of Clinical Research, Medical Director of the new VCU Parkinson's and Movement Disorders Clinic or Center. And the center there aims to integrate research, clinical care, and education and outreach missions in an interdisciplinary collaborative approach to making a difference in movement disorders. Dr. Testa moved to VCU in 2011, where she's very excited to lead a new Huntington's disease program. Dr. Testa, welcome back to the show. We had you on a few times ago, and we're so happy to have you back. How are you tonight?
I'm great. I'm really thrilled to be on. Thanks for having me back again.
Oh, it's exciting to have you back on. And Dr. Testa just come back from a movement disorders conference in Stockholm, which we'll get to talk to her a little bit about. But so first of all, I wanted to ask you if you could just kind of tell us about your experience as a student traveling to Maracaibo, because you went to Venezuela as a student, and we're, you know, this is always very interesting to all of us, and how you did there, and what about that transformed your experience?
Well, that's true. I was working on my PhD, my graduate work, with Ann Young and Jack Penny, the leads in the lab, and they were part of the original group of researchers who first started going down with Nancy Wexler to Maracaibo, and they went every year. And so I basically begged and grumbled to go with them for one of the trips as I was finishing up and finishing up the medical school half of my training. So they said, sure. And that was just wonderful. I went down with the whole research team, stayed in a hotel in Maracaibo, but basically every day we're out 10 hours, 12 hours, however long it took, driving around to all these tiny fishing towns around the lake. The lake is enormous. It's like one of the Great Lakes in the U.S. There's all these oil rigs out on it. And most of the people we saw lived in small villages scattered around the rim of the lake, but there were people in other villages as well. And it was just really amazing to see all of these people, from little kids to elderly people, waiting very patiently sometimes for a long time in people's backyards and random buildings, in courtyards, waiting to see the research team and get their exam. I held a video camera, I did the exam. They were getting blood drawn. They were answering questions about their family. People were double-checking the family trees. They were giving semen samples. That was probably the most entertaining. The young men would vaporize and then race back, have races to see who would bring their container of semen sample back. Because the researchers were using that to try to figure out when expansions in the mutation happened. It was just really impressive. It's a big research team, but the family effort, all of these people, and these are people who were often living, you know, the entire family in a spotlessly clean, single-room, dirt floor shack with a tin roof and maybe a chair and then hammocks for the main furniture.
Wow.
And they were all there, you know. Mm. They were all there, ready to go. And many of them had been in the study for many years.
Well, how long had the study been going on by that time, by the time you got there?
Oh, gosh. It had been going on, I would say, about 10 years.
Okay.
By the time I got there.
Quite a bit of research already being done.
So,
wow.
Yeah, 10 or 12 years by the time that I got the opportunity to go down with them. They took a Polaroid of each patient. That was one of my jobs, one of the most fun jobs, was getting to work the Polaroid and vary their pictures, because it took two pictures of everybody. One went into the research file and the other gave to the person. And you would go to the homes, and sometimes you would see, you know, the only photographs or images in some of these homes were these rows of Polaroids of the family members that they had kept from the prior years.
Wow. That's a stark image, isn't it?
It's just amazing. It's also amazing to be in these places, and then you kind of look out the courtyard and then the street, and you just see all of these people with Huntington's disease coming at you. coming towards the research center.
Right.
We saw a lot of juvenile cases. But just how Huntington's disease had permeated these villages and the interconnected families.
That must have made a very impactful impression on you as a student, right?
Definitely.
How long were you there as a student studying?
I was there for 3 weeks.
Wow. Did you go back?
I did not. I went to residency and on to other things. It was hard to get a chunk of time, even a week. I lobbied to go back because I'm selfish and I love experiences like that, but my Spanish is pretty weak. So the team was, if they were looking for add-ons that weren't specific people, students, they were looking for people who could survive on their own without a translator and contribute more, which made perfect sense. And then for a while, unfortunately, there were a lot of safety issues, and so there were several years that the team didn't go. And I don't think currently they're going for the same reason.
Did they have trouble getting permission to go? Is that why? Did they have trouble?
No, I think that just the local physician and researchers that they worked with just didn't feel like the team would be safe.
Oh, wow.
So that's unfortunately caused some suspensions in the visits. But I did not have the opportunity to go back.
There?
But it was really amazing. I'm sorry?
Are they still doing research there?
I am not sure if they are still going back, because I remember asking, and they had suspended the trips a little while ago, and I don't want to make stuff up. I'm not sure if they have returned to going. But I just know that, you know, this is the family, all those blood samples, all those family trees, that's where we got the finding the mutation.
I know.
From that study. That was really, really impressive. That's really got me hooked on Huntington's disease, just seeing the concept that a research team could undertake something that was at the time completely new. People had not, prior to that, said, okay, all we've got is the disease in the people. And it looks like it's autosomal dominant. That's all we've got to go on. Mm-hmm. We can find the gene. Let's do it. They haven't done that before. So those teams really, really put together a lot of new work. And then the effort it took on the part of this massive family and community was also, you know, them showing up to get poked and prodded and interviewed every year for years. For that breakthrough, so that kind of joint effort and those collaborative teams is just really amazing to see in action.
Are there any other dominant autosomal dominant genetic mutations like Huntington's that there's like this founder's effect going on? Do you know of?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. There are a lot of autosomal dominant diseases where it's known mutation that moves through families in a similar way to the way Huntington's disease mutation does. And in some disorders, almost all the mutations seem to be new. For whatever reason, the gene seems to be in an area of DNA that changes a lot. There's been some kind of hotspot that tends to be very mutable. And in others, it seems to be quite stable. You know, one person has the mutation, and that's it. You know, that mutation is carried forward in time, but there's not a lot of new ones that crop up. The thing about the Huntington's disease mutation that in part made it hard to find when it was also the first triplet repeat expansion mutation, people didn't even know that that was a disease-causing kind of change in a gene.
Right.
Before that was found for Huntington's disease, previously we knew about a bunch of other kinds of problems in genes, but we didn't know about that one. And after that was discovered, people immediately said, well, if that's what happens in Huntington's disease, what if that happens in other things? And went running around. And now there are lots of examples of triplet repeat mutation disorders, some of them also movement disorders, that people went looking for that cause for diseases once they realized that that mechanism was at work in Huntington's disease. So that really broke open a completely new field.
Wow. Are they on different chromosomes, or are they still on the...
Yeah, on a bunch of different chromosomes. Probably the most well-known is Fragile X.
Okay.
This is on the X chromosome and is the most common cause of inherited mental retardation in children in the U.S.
And that's a dominant?
As far as I'm aware.
Is that a dominant?
It's an X-link because it's on the X chromosome.
Okay.
So the inheritance works a little differently, but it's also a triplet repeat expansion.
Is it from the female? Or?
Mm-hmm. So it's always in the X chromosome, and so the... usually boys are more affected because they only have the mutation. They have an X and a Y, and their X has the mutation, whereas girls have the two X's, and so they often have one X that's okay. Another example in movement disorders, there's a family of things called spinal cerebellar ataxias, and this can cause a range of movement disorders. Ataxias, you have a lot of trouble targeting your movement. You have a lot of trouble with gait and balance. You can also have symptoms that kind of look on the outside like Parkinson's disease. Some of the spinal cerebellar ataxias are caused by mutations in different chromosomes, but the mutation is similar to the Huntington's disease gene mutation in terms of the expansion, how it's autosomal dominant, and how it can expand across generations.
Can it be confused with Huntington's? Or
it's possible but unusual. I remember seeing one family with a type of spinal cerebellar ataxia that people were questioning if it was Huntington's disease because the family members were relatively young onset and they were kind of slow and stiff, and sometimes the young onset, juvenile onset Huntington's disease patients can be very slow and stiff and not really have a lot of chorea. But that got sorted out in the genetic testing pretty quickly.
So it's specific in the genetic testing.
Yes. So you look for the specific change on the specific gene. Within a specific gene.
Right. Wow.
So then you can check one by one for specific mutations, or you can look more broadly. I think the thing that's fascinating to me and what's really drawn me in part to Huntington's disease is that all this stuff we're talking about is that the Huntington's disease community and the Huntington's disease researchers have led the way and broke open all this new stuff, whether it's how to deal with pre-symptomatic testing and counseling, the type of mutation, and now it's about how do you act on that kind of mutation, how might you treat that, how could you possibly put people at risk in clinical trials? Isn't that unethical because you don't know if they're going to get Huntington's disease or not, so now you're putting them at treatment risk, but somehow we're working out ways to do that ethically and effectively. So in all of these steps, Huntington's disease is a relatively rare disorder, but then breaking open new areas that impact lots of other patients and families too.
That's incredible. So we have many, many people in Venezuela, Maracaibo, Venezuela, to thank for that, and all of our people here, right? Individuals here.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's, well, just, it's really the power of the research participation. Without all of those people showing up at their research visits, kind of eyeballing these crazy people from all over the world flying to talk to them, and sticking with it, once a year for a bunch of years, that participation was what broke it all open, and that kind of research participation, whether it's a 10-minute survey or a multi-hour clinical trial visit, that's still, the critical thing that moves things forward.
I was hoping that more of our physicians would go into research. There are many physicians that they kind of get stuck in their practice and don't do the clinical trials so much.
I think it's difficult to balance things. The clinical practice is high demand in terms of time and focus. I'm only in clinic part-time, but I don't have part-time patients. Mm-hmm. So I can't really in the middle of the clinic say, hey, guess what, guys? I could really use half an hour, maybe even an hour for my research study right now in the middle of the clinic. But in the middle of my research days, people feel free to let me know I really need to call a patient family and get something done for them. Because that's important. So
patient
balance is hard. I think one of the things that I'm the most hopeful is that there are still physicians going into research or interested in research at all levels, whether it's bench science or human subject stuff or clinical trials. And now we're seeing more people across different disciplines, not just MDs, going into research or thinking harder about ways to approach the problem. So whether that's physical therapists looking at interventions that work on gait and balance through the impact of exercise, or it's biochemists who haven't really thought about Huntington's disease before and thinking about metabolic problems, or the genetic counselor that I work with actually is now mentoring a master's student, student who wants to do her master's thesis project with us about pre-symptomatic genetic testing in Huntington's disease and how that may have changed over time. That's really exciting. Oh, I have to give them a plug. They'll be at HDSA. Everyone should go to their table and take their survey, participate in the research.
Are you
super
going
awesome.
To convention?
Yeah, so they're going to be at HDSA at the VCU. They'll have a table for St. Commonwealth University and our Huntington's disease program in the exhibit hall. They have a little 10-minute survey. If you have ever thought about, considered, or might ever do or have decided not to do pre-symptomatic testing, if you've ever basically been at risk for Huntington's disease, they want to hear from you.
Good.
So if you have ever been at risk for Huntington's disease, they want to hear from you because they're trying to figure out how has pre-symptomatic testing evolved and how can the field change with it. And I'm just excited to see a different kind of professional develop research interest in Huntington's disease.
We're talking about pre-symptomatic testing. I know that there are some physicians that just absolutely refuse to test. They just will not test. And, you know, I have a personal opinion about that, but I know that there are many, you know, issues surrounding testing somebody. Do you think that's going to be changing anytime soon?
I think I think that that kind of thing will change because, for one thing, there's more and more education out there. And it just came from a disorders meeting. But I also last month went to the American Academy of Neurology meeting, which has a lot more generalists, people who aren't movement disorder specialists.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of stuff at that meeting about types of genetic testing, new technologies, you know, how this is coming down the pipe one way or another. And so there's a lot more education now for physicians. And there's also too gradually for my taste, but slowly there's more access to genetic counseling.
Yes.
So I'm really lucky at VCU. There's a really terrific clinical genetics group that does a lot of work that has both MDs and a pack of genetic counselors, and they've been extremely welcoming to encounter Huntington's disease program as their own genetic counselor that wants to connect with that community. So I see that the genetic counseling community growing.
That's wonderful.
So that those kind of professionals can take the time that physicians and might not feel they have to do good counseling, and to also have the knowledge to be able to give good information. And I think physicians are just really going to be forced to figure it out.
What about neuropsychiatry?
This information is more and more out there.
Mm-hmm.
How about what?
What about neuropsychiatry?
Yeah,
is more education becoming available about Huntington's to that?
I think so.
Field?
So again, I'm lucky. I work with a neuropsychiatrist, Adam Rosenblatt, who was at Hopkins for a long time. We've known each other for a long time because I was at Emory at the Center of Excellence there for a long time, and he was at Hopkins for a long time, and now we're both at VCU. And he has a pack of residents interested in doing neuropsychiatry fellowships with him. There's a lot of need out there in the land of psychiatry in general. I'm finding, again, slowly, but I'm finding more psychiatrists interested in the intersections between neurology and psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
I also find that people are using neuropsychologists more. We have a neuropsychologist in our group who's a PhD. She's doing both clinical care and research with our movement disorders patients. And that discipline I see more and more in interdisciplinary care centers and being used more. Because, again, they approach the problem in terms of cognitive and behavioral and mood symptoms from another angle. And they have their own set of interventions that aren't medication but can be really powerful. And again, it's just another way to get at things. It expands the thinking.
I think if we catch it early, maybe it's a little bit easier, but I don't know, to manage, you know, the psychiatric components.
I think that that is, I think that that's, it's I'm going to phrase this badly, so that's why I'm backing up.
I know.
Must be the jet lag.
Sorry about that. This is totally unscripted, everybody. back
so,
up. Hold the bus.
Back up. So I think that mood and behavioral symptoms and cognitive symptoms are just challenging across the board. I don't know if they're early or late. I'm challenging across the board. And
didn't mean to light a fire there for you.
I've learned to, you know, not be afraid to tackle them just because I've been forced to learn and grow with my patients.
Yeah.
And I also am not afraid to, you know, phone a friend to talk to our neuropsychologist, to talk to a neuropsychiatrist, to talk to someone in another Huntington Center to try to be creative. So I think that those symptoms, but they are manageable. And I think that's something that we forget, especially about mood symptoms, that unlike many symptoms in Huntington's disease, we do have a lot of choices for mm-hmm. psychiatric symptoms, for medication treatment, for non-medication treatment. There's a pretty big range of interventions. And I think that the fear of those symptoms sometimes, I think the fear of those symptoms sometimes holds people back.
Yeah.
In terms of trying to treat them, or even in terms of using other therapies. So as you know, I'm the co-PI on two clinical trials that are up and running.
Yes.
The intervention is SD-809, which is a deuterated form of tetrabenazine. This is for chorea control. So
right.
This is to improve chorea control. We're out to test whether this new agent is going to be safe and effective and be at least as effective, if not better tolerated than tetrabenazine. We don't know that yet. That's why we're out
and
to try to
can
prove
back
it.
Up just a second on that?
But I wanted to say that one of the things that people are afraid of with tetrabenazine and with other chorea treatments is they're afraid of mood symptoms. They're afraid of maybe making depression worse or causing a problem in a realm that's actually possible to monitor and possible to treat.
Okay, well, let's tell our listeners what you're talking about. We're talking about FIRST HD, ARC HD. This is an HSG clinical study happening with the SD-809. Auspex is the pharmaceutical company. And you've been involved in many clinical trials. And what can you explain to us? I'm sure that our listeners out there are saying, what is deuterated? What does that mean?
So deuterium, deuterium is a natural compound. It's found in all of our bodies. It substitutes for hydrogen. So water is usually hydrogen and oxygen, for example. So if you put in deuterium instead, it's called heavy water. The deuterium forms a stronger bond with other molecules compared to the hydrogen. So this is a clever organic chemistry. You look at how a drug's active metabolites get broken down. So you take a medication, has an active form in your body, does its job, and then your body breaks it down and clears it, right? And then it's done. So
this is used in
if you put the deuterium in the places where it gets broken down, then you can stretch out its effective life, and you can prevent big peaks that sometimes cause side effects, and you can hopefully, again, we're out to prove these things, we don't know them yet, take things fewer times a day, so something that was three or four times a day, go down to twice a day, because you're slowing down that breakdown and smoothing out how it works without actually changing fundamentally how it works, so you get the theory that we're hoping to prove, that you get the same benefit profile. But you can tolerate it better. So deuterium is not radioactive. It's already in your body, just putting it in very specific places. And I think that, once again, Huntington's disease is first in line. People do use water with deuterium in it in some medical imaging practices. So I don't want to get too in the weeds with that. But there's no approved drug for anything with deuterium in it right now, but there are a bunch of others in the pipeline. So Huntington's disease could hold the first indication for deuterated drug. There's a couple exciting things about these trials. One is that you mentioned that you'd wish more doctors would go into research. Six has done a really good job of looking to increase research participation in sites that may have done HSG studies in the past but haven't done it in a while or have built up a Huntington's disease practice over time but haven't participated in trials. So in the middle of training up and getting activated some extra sites. So I think that hopefully they'll have a good experience and then want to continue onward with HSG and with other, with Huntington Study Group and with other trials in the future.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's talk about HSG. What is your current, what are you doing with HSG now? I know you're co-PI for First and ARC.
Yep.
But what else are you doing there?
So I'm also on the executive committee. I'm finishing out my term. I'll be done in November. I'm part of the planning committee for the program for the Huntington Study Group meeting in November and the clinical research update day. There's, as I was telling you right before the show started, there's three kind of parallel tracks with the Huntington Study Group meeting. It is a professional meeting for the group, so there's closed sessions where you do training for clinical trials or the specific trials. The sites get together, or we talk about our bylaws, do business. But there's also teaching sessions for local providers so that anybody, local provider who wants to learn more about Huntington's disease can do a parallel track of sessions for them plus general sessions. And then there's lots of open sessions that patients and families come to. And then the whole day Saturday is really dedicated for patients and family community. So it's terrific to see a lot of people there.
Fantastic. Are they offering CMEs for the physicians?
Yes.
Is that what that is? Okay.
Ooh.
And,
oh,
and
we offered CME last year, and I'm not in front of my computer to check if we're doing that again this year. I'm going to have to backfill that one and get back to you so you can put it the correct answer on your site. I know we did last year, and I can't remember if we're going to be able to do that this year or not.
Oh, yeah, I remembered that last year. And so then tell us what your main focus right now is with HD. I know your movement disorders, and you just came back from this awesome conference, but and I still want to talk to you about that. But what are you doing now in HD?
So the thing that's taking the most hours is definitely the first HD and ARC-HD trials right now. That's because this is a treatment for chorea in HD that could turn around and come out to the community pretty rapidly by the end of next year if we get this trial enrolled and we get the data, and then it looks like it really would be a benefit to the HD community, then this is these are the trials that the FDA needs to decide. And so we're really, really pushing to get our enrollment done this summer so that we can have the data analyzed, have everything the FDA needs, everything that we need to be convinced that we have a clear up or down answer to know what to do, and then have the sponsor have enough time to bring it out to the market. So this is really crunch time for those trials because we really want to succeed, get them enrolled, and bring out something new for the community. We prove that it's worthwhile. So so again, another plug. You'll be seeing the Ustix HSG and the different site booths at HDSA, or you can go to the Huntington Study Group website to learn about trials if you have chorea in Huntington's disease or if you're already taking tetrabenazine, either way. We definitely want to hear from you. So that's taking the most hours. The thing that I've done a lot of in the past and are just sinking my teeth into at VCU is I've participated in a lot of the long-term observational studies. So these are also research studies, but they don't have intervention like a new pill or a new surgery. They're observing people kind of like the Venezuela research group did to try to learn a lot more about Huntington's disease, what actually happens to people, what are their biggest concerns, and to use that knowledge to say, this is how we should be looking into what new treatments are. This is where we should be going with the research. So I was really fortunate to participate with Pharos, which was at-risk people who chose not to know their genetic mutation status, as well as PREDICT-HD, which is people who knew that they had a mutation and joined the study before they started showing symptoms, and cohort. And now VCU is a site for Enroll-HD, which is a massive and amazing international effort to kind of fold all these registries together and track people with HD or at risk or even just family members through over time with annual visits and build up the kind of network and database that can really successfully drive figuring out mechanisms of how Huntington's disease works and targets for trials. So we're now an open Enroll-HD site, and so we've been focusing on getting more people there. We're working on our site status for PRIDE-HD, another interventional study that's not up and running at our site yet, but we're targeting late summer. Would like to see more studies up and running at VCU. I love it that we're sucking in people like physical therapists and genetic counselors to look at Huntington's disease from different angles. And then I really believe that to successful clinical research, human subjects research, so not the flies and the worms, but working directly with people, is most successful in an environment where there's also a very active, healthy, interdisciplinary clinical care program. Because you're really learning from your patients and families, you know, where the real concerns are and where the real action is. So VCU is still relatively new, but we've got a bunch of really excited, wonderful staff and have been slowly building up our patient base. It's exciting to see more and more people. I would love to see that grow too.
Can you talk about PRIDE-HD at all?
So PRIDE-HD is a double-blind, placebo-controlled study with pradopidine. This is an agent that's been tested mainly in Europe, but also to some extent in the U.S. Before in HD, the theory is with motor symptoms across the board. So the type of research participants that the study will be looking for are people with a range of motor symptoms. So that's in contrast, first HD and ARC-HD are really looking for people with chorea in Huntington's disease who want to volunteer. PRIDE-HD will be looking for people with a range of motor symptoms looking at a range of measures in motor function to try to figure out if this drug really does help with those symptoms in Huntington's disease and come forward. Teva is the sponsor, and it's being run in several countries, including parts of Europe and the U.S. and I believe Australia as well.
Very good. We have a comment from the chat room from Doc for HD. He says, "Go, Claudia! Working in clinical research really does take much juggling and dedicated time." Very true. Thanks for your comment.
That's got to be Sam.
Yep, it is. Hi, Sam. Thanks
awesome
for this.
Researcher.
Yep. And on the clinical care side, talk about that with us, if you don't mind.
So I was very, very lucky to train as a student with people who did both research and clinical care. So I just saw that model, you know, growing up in my training. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then when I moved to Emory, and we had the first HGSA Center of Excellence, and the people there are really tremendous, and it was really interdisciplinary. There's a clinical psychologist, genetic counseling, neurologist, multiple research coordinators who are familiar with the Huntington's disease community, a social worker, which is really critical. And over time, after I got there, we kind of sucked in physical therapy and psychiatry. And the group really worked as a team. We had real team meetings. Everybody across the team, even the front desk secretary, really knew who all the patients and families were.
Wow.
So I really wanted to rip off all of the great stuff that I had seen at Emory and just steal all of their best ideas.
Can I be ripped
from
off?
From the time there. So that was my main goal, to take all the great stuff, steal all of it. So I knew we needed social work. We do have a part-time but dedicated to Huntington's disease social worker. I wanted genetic counseling. That was really key. And I'm very lucky that our genetic counselor is also my research coordinator, research manager. So that's a fantastic combination for us.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted psychiatry, so I was thrilled when I learned that Anna was considering moving. And I actually stole the physical therapist from Emily.
You do a lot of ripping off and stealing, don't you?
Oh, it's terrible. So I now have a therapist, which is new. I'm still learning how to best connect her with our patients. So we want people to know that they can get a range of care from people who have many years' experience with Huntington's disease. I would love to build up our patient base and our services to the point that we can earn a Center of Excellence distinction once they reopen that. Right now they're not accepting applications, but I hear rumors that they will hopefully later this year. So we're trying to get all our ducks in a row so that we can grow towards that goal. And I love being able to connect the clinical care to the research as much as patients and families are willing to tolerate, whether that's just using our clinical database registry where you don't have to do anything. You just steal data out of the medical record, being stealing, or if we use our connections to say, well, you don't really need or want any clinical care, but here's the support group information.
Right.
Here's a way to connect with the Virginia Beach people because they live a lot closer to you than we do. So
are you guys doing
those
surveys?
Connections.
Many surveys at all in your area?
Any surveys?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you asked?
Yes, surveys.
So,
surveying the community.
I think I may have misheard you. Can you try that one more time?
Surveying your community for information about what they're looking for.
Yes. So neuropsychologist that I work with, Sarah Loggeman, did a needs assessment survey with her graduate students. It's about a year and a half ago now. We had very, very few Huntington's disease patients participate in that because we had just opened the program. We hadn't connected with very many people. So it was open to everyone in the movement disorders community across the spectrum, so Parkinson's disease people and tremor people and Huntington's disease people. So we've done a small version of that. And I think as we get more connected in the region, it would be worthwhile to do a larger version. Right now, the only survey we're doing is looking at people's use of and reactions to pre-symptomatic genetic testing, like I talked about earlier.
Very interesting. So what's going to be in your future? I know you're working on First in ARC. That's huge.
So we've really had the luxury at our Movement Disorder Center of having a terrific education and outreach person. And she has turned her attention to Huntington's disease at my request this summer, in part because we're working hopefully towards a center of excellence when those applications come back out, mm-hmm. but also because there's other groups in the region that we're lucky to have to connect with. So Georgetown has a new center, UVA, of course, has been around for a while, and they have wonderful experience. So last spring, we did a Huntington's Disease Community Education Day and connected between the different groups and centers in our region. And so we want to make that biannual, make it larger, get more access to different people. We got terrific participation, actually, from a pack of occupational therapy students who just then all became obsessed with Huntington's disease. So I see it as a way to get more students interested, too. So that's something, the education, whether it's for other types of providers or whether it's connecting with a patient family community, I'd like to see that grow. And we're working on expanding our interdisciplinary range. My nurse manager has a meeting with the palliative care group coming up. While we all want to, gene silence things out of existence, in the meantime, we have people who have real care needs,
of course,
at end of life. And then connected to that, we're working on setting up telemedicine access so that we'd be able to have connect our expertise with people that it really is way too burdensome to get in a car and drive however many hours one way. That's just not necessary like it used to be. So we've been working through the labor contracts and the equipment, and then we're targeting trying to pilot a couple of telemedicine patients
with,
in the late summer and go from there. Do we have what coming up?
Are you in contact with Ray Dorsey on that?
Yes, I've talked to him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I also know Kevin Bigman really well. They're both really smart thinkers. I saw Kevin at the Movement Disorders meeting that I was just at.
Very good.
We're very excited.
And then
the
last thing, and then obviously expanding Enroll-HD, I want to see more projects that we're driving. I had a metabolomics project with a biochemistry group at Emory leveraging off of Predict-HD that unfortunately we only did a pilot. We couldn't get the larger thing funded, but we've been trying to talk again about how can we rethink some projects. Can we get that pushed? Can we expand our clinical care into nutrition? So just not just contributing to those really critical databases, long-term databases, but also generating the primary projects. And then the last thing is I do a lot of work in tremor with the Movement Disorder Society and the Tremor Task Force and the Tremor Research Group. And that's taught me a lot about how those kind of task force can be helpful and kind of what their evil downsides are as well. I've heard a lot of feedback in the last couple of years from the patient family community, a lot of frustration with how Huntington's disease is diagnosed, with the current battles and the disability legislation. You have to have motor, it can't just be cognitive, blah, blah, blah. When there's a lot of data coming out of these studies that really demonstrates that cognitive and behavioral symptoms can be early, can be first, that there's a range of motor symptoms, that everybody's experience can be a little different. So I took the opportunity of the Movement Disorder Society to start to float the idea that, you know, the professional international body, just like we're thinking about Parkinson's disease and we're thinking about tremor and other things, shouldn't we think about Huntington's disease? Hasn't our knowledge grown so that we can hear that frustration and do something different about how we define clinical diagnosis or figure out a data-driven way to make statements so that providers out in the community understand better how to diagnose this so that patients and families have more accurate data. So that's really, really embryonic, and I've probably just massacred politically my chances.
I'm
forward.
If we've
been
listening to you to go to Congress
so
yet.
I mean, this is like an idea in my head that I pounced on the president of the Movement Disorder Society and had a 3-minute conversation with him about. And he said, okay, so the first thing you need to do is write to me this, and then you can join the science committee. But I think that
well, the groundwork
putting Huntington's disease at the center instead of at the margins of these big designs would be exciting.
Claudia, the groundwork has to be done, and that's what you're doing. You're doing the research. You're discovering all of these, you know, facts, and that's what it takes, right? Before you can do anything else. So, and education is just key to everything. So, the more we educate our physicians and our, you know, care providers, the better. I mean, that's foundational.
And the more
right?
we learn from the research studies with people, the more we know we're actually answering or looking at the questions that matter to patients. That we're not making assumptions based on models, or we're not making assumptions based on our pet biological pathway, but we're actually
and
trying
Dr.
to look at things that matter.
The advanced HD population can still contribute to research. That comes from Sam.
Yeah.
And that is so true.
I think that's a great, great statement. I do hear a lot of frustration from our families that they look at a lot of the interventional clinical trials and say, well, you have to be living at home. You have to be ambulatory. You have to be able to get you have to be working and driving. So this, you know, this isn't for my family member. Why not? But but proving that telemedicine is worthwhile, participating in Enroll HD and pushing, saying, you know, these
it's
are
all
the
valuable.
Things for people to look at. I think that it's definitely possible to grow the research with that population too. It's not just for early phase people.
Right. And it's all valuable research, whatever stage and whatever purpose the clinical trial or study is for. It's all valuable and important information that we need.
Yeah, I think I tend to get over excited. I'm like, oh, I could do this and this and this and this. there's a lot of fascinating stuff to learn about and to participate with.
Well, Dr. Tessa, this has been very fascinating, and can you believe we've almost been talking for an hour on the radio? Time flies. But I'd like to wrap it up here so that we can have the rest of the evening. Is there anything that you wanted to mention? I know you're going to HDSA convention. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to mention.
No, I think just running through my plugs again because my research staff works so hard.
Symposium.
The Huntington Study Group convention is in November. Huntington Study Group convention is in November. There's tons for patients and families there. So check out the Huntington Study Group website, and it's a great resource. Look for FIRST HD and ARC HD on the HST website if you have chorea and Huntington's disease, not on treatment, or if you are on tetrabenazine. Either way, we want to hear from you this summer. And then if
you're
going
to, too.
And if you're going to HDSA, look for the Virginia Commonwealth University gang. They really want to hear about your experiences being at risk and thinking about pre-symptomatic testing.
Yes,
so what's your announcement?
My announcement is our Health for HD International, our first annual symposium, is going to be July 18 and 19 here in Santa Maria, Symposium 2014. We have 12 very high-profile keynote speakers. Ira Shulson will be with us physically. Ray Dorsey is going to come to us through the patient portal, and we're going to talk about Huntington Connect, the telemedicine clinical trial. Then we have Neil Hermanowitz. He's the UCI MD. We have Suzanne Pontal. She's a PhD co-director of the umbilical cord blood collection program. Dr. Pignopoulos is going to be with us, physically with us. I'm so excited. We're going to have a representative from GPI, which is the Genetics Policy Institute, Alan Fernandez. He is the associate director of GPI. Then Dr. Jan Nolte will be with us. She's a professor director of UC Davis Stem Cell Program. Kevin McCormick will be with us. He's Cations Director at CIRM. Teresa Temkin will be with us. She is RNC, University of California, Davis Medical Center, Department of Neurology, Center of Excellence here in California at UC Davis. Ellen Feigl, she's the MD. She's a Senior VP of R&D at CIRM, which is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Dr. LaVon Goodman will be with us. Her husband, Nathan Goodman, will be with us. And then we are so blessed to have Auspex Pharmaceutical and Griffin Foundation supporting this symposium for us this year. We're also going to have some amazing international attendees from the Mexico City Huntington's Associations, Brenda Vega, Veronica Ruiz, and Margaret Gallardo from the Mexico City. Then we're also going to be holding CMEs and a CU. We have a Health for HD International has a joint agreement with the Dignity Health System here and the Santa Barbara County Consortium for Medical Education. It's a one-time agreement for to hold these CMEs and CEU. And please go to the website, helphdinternational.org, and go to events and register and come on over to Santa Maria because we are really going to have a great time, a lot of education information. And next year we're hoping to open a clinic for Huntington's disease and other movement disorders here in Santa Maria. We have nothing here right now as far as Center of Excellence or any kind of clinic that cares for Huntington's, Parkinson's, movement disorders. And we need something really bad here. So that's what we're up to. And Dr. Testa, I just want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. And I think you and I could work out a schedule for a regular show if you're interested. It wouldn't be probably a whole hour, but we could certainly come up with some topics if you're interested and help educate our community. What do you think?
That's really flattering. I would love to do that.
Okay, on.
And your Alrighty. Symposium just sounds amazing, a beautiful part of the world and quite a lineup. I love the way you opened this. We'll have Ira Shulson in person.
Oh, he's such a great man. I'm so thrilled that he and Josie are coming, and I'm going to try to show them a good time, you know, try to give them something to remember. But anyway, so we'll go ahead and close the show. And again, Dr. Testa, thank you so much for spending this time with us and everyone for tuning in. And we'll conclude the show. And please come back and listen to the on-demand episodes, the archive episodes. Find us on Facebook or go to the website, helphdinternational.org. And please don't forget to tell your friends and family and colleagues about Help for HD Radio. Click follow on the show page and you'll get email reminders. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Everyone have a great night. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.